to my listening ears, all nature sings and round me rings the music of the spheres. This is my Father's world. I rest me.
Thank you for joining us today. We are live with 20 pages a week. At least I think we are. We are studying 20 pages a week with Zeke Flores today of Baytown, Texas. Zeke, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Glad to be with you.
Oh, glad to do it. We are in the second week of the Wisdom Quarter, which is largely composed of poetry books, but there are a few historical, what we would usually call historical books in this section. The favorite of mine in this section is Nehemiah, and in fact, by far my favorite of this section, going back to First Chronicles and going through Ezra. I gather that Zeke also has a fondness for Nehemiah.
Remember when you offered me the choice of what book I could chat with you about, this was my first choice. I think it's a favorite of a lot of people because a lot of people can relate not only to the troubles that Nehemiah had or that the Israelites had, but also to the sheer hope of the guy.
That's right. Why don't you give me some first impressions?
We studied this in a men's class here in Baytown several years ago, and it actually turned into kind of a leadership class. I didn't teach it, but I got to sit in on most of it, and it's a great book for realizing commitment, for recognizing devotion, and for applying yourself to be a part of the solution. That's what I love most about Nehemiah. You get this not only a bird's eye view of how teamwork happens from beginning to end, but also what happens when you find that at the end there are bumps in the road and how sometimes adjustments need to be made. It's just too good a book that I think we are going to find hard to cover in the 45 minutes that we have.
Well, it is hard, but it's a great book. If you're joining us a little bit late, this is Hal Hammonds and Zeke Flores. We're talking about Nehemiah this week. We're reading all the way through the Bible. Nehemiah is not especially long reading, but it is an intense reading, and a lot of the things that make for great stories, right? It's got the main protagonist, it's got the bad guys, it's got the central theme behind the whole thing. A lot of very easy practical applications, I think, for us as we go along the way and try to apply this to our life. Really, the whole book is essentially one story, but was there one aspect of the story that really jumped out at you?
Yeah, it was Nehemiah's hope. It was the fact that it would have been easy for him, 500, 600 miles away, to just lament the problem and say, man, I really hope they get it together, you know, with a bunch of knuckleheads and be done with it. But the trip that he took was not an easy one. I mean, depending on how he went, it's some 500 miles straight across the desert. It's another, I guess, 800-900 miles if you take kind of that curve over the Fertile Crescent. But either way, it would have been a tough trip for him to take, and he did it. And as soon as he gets there, I don't know if I'm jumping in too early, but as soon as he gets there, he goes and he surveys the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, he was, I think, the kind of guy that a lot of people look for in leadership, somebody who's gonna jump in and not talk something to death, but he's going to work toward a solution as quickly as possible.
That's exactly right. It's easy to send something to committee, especially if you are like the new guy in town. If there's an established leadership in place already, it would be easy for him to just come in and get some kind of report from somebody and kind of go with the flow and work his way in slowly. And that's not Nehemiah's style. And as it turns out, it's a good thing he takes that approach, because it becomes pretty evident early on that leadership is very seriously corrupted. to a certain degree, corrupted morally, but especially corrupted with regard to foreign influences and external powers that are in here. There are people in this area that do not want Nehemiah to succeed. That's pretty obvious. They have their own agendas that may or may not be hidden. And the idea of building a wall around Jerusalem is the last thing that they want. And so they'll do whatever they can to stop this work, whether it's ridicule or military insurgents, attempted assassinations. You got it all in Nehemiah.
Well, think about it. I mean, this project that Nehemiah stepped himself into started a lot longer before than Nehemiah had ever showed up. Even before Ezra came, there was some effort to maybe try to get it together in Jerusalem, and it just kind of petered out. One of the things I loved about Nehemiah was you were talking about the corruption, and we usually think about the foreigners, Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, these foreigners that were always trying to sabotage the act. Nehemiah went to people of the Israelites who themselves were corrupted. They were the reason why this project didn't go like it should have been when it was first in its inception. But what he does, I love, when he gets there, he goes and he surveys all the thing. And then when he goes to sell the project, he gets buy-in by including himself with them. In verse 17 of chapter 2, he tells them, "You see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates are burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach." It would have been easy for him, being gone so long, to point his finger at them and say, "Look what you knuckleheads did. Look what you've let happen." Mm-hmm. But he didn't. He identified with them, and I think that was part of his genius in getting their buy-in to do this, because this is the beginning of this great momentum that we see happening that resulted in the wall being built in 52 days. So, and I don't think it would have happened if Nehemiah hadn't let them see that he identified with them. I mean, even in his prayer in chapter 1, and that's, one of those other big overview things that we see in Nehemiah is the constant prayer this guy was in, just short little, "Oh Lord, help me, remember me," he keeps saying.
Right.
In the first prayer that we come to in chapter 1, he identifies himself with the national sin of Israel. And, he, as one of God's people, even today, it's important to realize that we are in this together. I mean, that was Paul's whole thing, right? Consider one another, one another, one another. It's always about thinking of your brethren first, considering yourself as, even though Christianity is an incredibly personal and intimate relationship with God, still it's not worked out in a vacuum. Our relationship with God is worked out in interaction with other people. And Nehemiah understood that as a member of that nation.
The prayer thing is really important. Like you mentioned, the short prayers, the long prayers, the personal prayers, the national prayers. Ezra went through the same kind of thing. Daniel goes through the same kind of thing a little bit later. If there's a problem with the nation, there's a problem with me. If there's fault to give to the nation, there's fault to give to me. It's not a preaching down to people who have a problem. It's we have a problem, and I'm part of we. So I find that terribly important. It's really easy for preachers, for instance, to preach out at them and talk about what you guys have as a problem. And to a certain degree, that's appropriate. There's no fault in pointing fingers where they need to be pointed. But everybody is part of this. If you are sinning, then you're part of the problem. And we're all sinning.
There isn't anybody, I think, who doesn't need to be reminded that we're in this together. And of course, as preachers, I'm pretty sure you try to do this as well. I let folks know that I've got my own weaknesses and I've got my own struggles, but that together we can encourage each other to overcome those things. That's what Nehemiah does. This faith that he exercises You see it in the planning and the organization that he puts together. That's what builds the momentum. And he does it in such a way that people feel connected to each other physically. I mean, when they were working on the wall in chapter three, it's, you look at chapter three and it's kind of a boring chapter. You know, this guy worked next to that guy and that guy worked next to this guy. And you got all these people, you got all these hard to pronounce names in different sections of the wall, you know, but you think about it. I mean, there are, in verse eight, he's got a goldsmith working next to a perfumer. What do those guys know about masonry? Mm-hmm. You know, but yet they're working on the wall. They're doing that. You got another guy who's working there. He's got his daughters helping out. So he not only has, you know, probably people who know what they're doing. He's got novices. He's got family members. He's got everybody invested in the work. He's got everybody recognizing that they all have not only a part to play, but a responsibility. And that, I think, is helpful for congregations today. When we recognize, you know, Paul tells us in Ephesians 4, one of my favorite verses in the whole Bible is Ephesians 4, verse 16, where he says that every one of us, you know, all of us together, supplying what every joint supplies, contributes to the building up of the body. Mm-hmm. There's something for everybody to do. Now, I don't know how good these goldsmiths and perfumers were at doing the heavy brick work. I think most of it was probably a lot of grunt work, but still, you know, perfumers aren't usually into heavy labor.
Right.
And yet that's what we find. We find everybody putting their shoulder to the work. What a great, great concept for congregations today. Mm-hmm. I think maybe at one time when the restoration movement was really gaining its momentum, people started seeing what it really took to be a family of the household of God, and they threw themselves into the work. And then we started finding ourselves faced with a whole lot of distractions, you know, TV and internet and just all kinds of other things to do, especially now with COVID. Man. Where we, even though there are more ways in which we can view religious teaching, we're more disconnected than ever, you know. And Nehemiah helped solve that in a physical way.
Yeah, and through the study in the Kings, I made a point of emphasizing throughout our study the fallacy and ultimately the failure in the case of Judah of top-down morality, top-down service to God. A king comes in and he tries to legislate a relationship with God, and it looks like it works. There's a lot of destruction. There's a lot of rebuilding. There's a lot of cleanup, and everything looks fine. And then the king dies, and it goes back to normal. There's a built-in failure. It doesn't have to be a failure, but especially if it's just a one-off generation, if it's just one king, if it's just Asa, if it's just Josiah or whatever, it's difficult to enact real long-term change top-down. Usually it works much, much better if it is bottom up, if you have a real groundswell of change. But occasionally you have a situation like Nehemiah where you have a strong leader come in and encourage people to do the work. And there is actually an undercurrent of people who want to do the work, but for whatever reason aren't motivated. They know what the right thing is, but they have a mind to work, as the famous verse says in chapter 4, verse 6. I don't want to steal any thunder for you. I don't know if that's a verse you have in mind, but the idea of people wanting to work, but not really finding the motivation, not knowing the tools at hand, being scared, whatever it happens to be, and a leader can come in and get the best out of them in that situation. That can be a terribly important role for a leader.
One of the things you were mentioning about this, you know, not being top down, you know, not speaking down to those who you're trying to get buy-in from. Nehemiah showed himself as a real example in that by something as practical as paying for his own food.
Right.
You know, one of the things he done, you know, I don't know what kind of entertainment expenses a governor of the province might have had back then, but you know, he mentions the fact that, hey, there's a lot of people eating at my table and I'm paying for it all. and in a time when everybody was taxing everybody else and trying to get whatever they could from their countrymen. He shows them, he not only talks the talk, he walks the walk. He reminded them how important it was. I was thinking, if I could sum up those chapters of Nehemiah where all the work was being done, I don't know why, but I thought of the Three Musketeers, right? All for one and one for all, right?
Right.
That's kind of like, that's what that reminds me of.
And it really is, you know, it's this camaraderie. And maybe you've been in a situation like this, but when you have a big project that could, under certain circumstances, be daunting, could be intimidating, could be terrifying, and you have the spirit like they had in Joshua's day, for instance, where the size of the project is an encouragement. It is a morale booster instead of a detraction, because you know you have strong leadership. You know you have buy-in from your neighbors. If I have a chance to be a part of something small or be part of something big, why wouldn't I want to be part of something big? Why wouldn't I want to make a real difference, a real impact? And when you have that buy-in, when you have that cooperation, spirit, like in a individual congregation is probably the best example, most important example. When you have that spirit, the bigger the challenge you find, the more motivated people get. And great things happen, not because we do such a great job, but because we as a collective, we as a body have put ourselves in God's hands and said, do what you want with us.
Have you heard of a book called Do Hard Things?
No, Chris Emerson has that.
Okay, it's a really good book.
No, that's the brothers, isn't it?
Right. They were teenagers when they wrote it. They were in their late teens when they wrote it. But it really is filled with a lot of wisdom that kind of transcends the late teenage years. I remember my teenage years. I didn't have that kind of wisdom. But some of the things that they said about doing hard things, one of the things was do things that are so big you need help to do them. You know, rely on other people. I heard Tim Jennings say one time in a sermon that we need to make plans so big that the only way we can complete them is with God's help. And even though we do the physical work ourselves, all through this, you see Nehemiah relying on God's help. That's what all his prayers are all about. Remember me, remember me, remember me, he keeps saying. Sometimes we feel as though we're the only ones working and God is some distant onlooker of what we're doing for him. When we stop to consider that, no, God allows us to partner with him in the work that not only benefits us, but brings him honor and glory, it changes the whole dynamic of that thing. I think that's what we see going on in Nehemiah. Nehemiah knew that if anything was going to get done, for sure the people needed to have a mind to work, but they also had to have their mind on God. They had to realize that he was going to be the one that was going to perform the ultimate help for them. I love that. I love what Tim said. You know, make plans so big that only God, they can only be accomplished if God helps.
I love that too. That's a great way of looking at it. God will help. Not always, and this is one of the cautionary tales, the cautionary lessons with regard to Old Testament stories. They all tend to work out really well. The good guys work really hard, and they devote themselves to God. Daniel gets out of the lion's den. Joseph gets raised to be the leader of Egypt. It always seems to come together in the end. And that's not always the case with us, in the short term at least, in this life. And it's not always the case for people in the Old Testament either. Josiah gets shot in his chariot, etc. There are bad things that happen to good people when they're doing good things. But when we can see the overall picture, the spiritual picture that God's trying to accomplish in us, that it's not about getting one particular wall built. It's not about taking a stand against one particular enemy. It's about searching for heaven. It's about pursuing God's things. God can give us the confidence that we are going to meet that goal. We are going to meet that objective with his help.
There's some principles in Nehemiah, I think, that will help us. Sometimes I see the church today falling into kind of like this, the cycle of the judges. You're talking about how, right, how, you know, it doesn't always work out so well. And I see that more and more today. There was a potential in Nehemiah's time for them to start with this great big enthusiasm and then have it sputter out. And we see that later on. We see it after Nehemiah goes away and he comes back and he sees all this stuff that's going on, everything that he had put in place that people had abandoned. But when they started, I mean, we love the beginning of the story, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's so much promise in it. They had this compelling purpose. Let's rebuild Jerusalem. Let's rebuild this wall. Let's get down to who we are as God's people. And they had a clear perspective. God was going to help them see who they were as their people, but it was up to them to grasp the vision. And Nehemiah helps them do that. And they did it by continual prayer. It doesn't tell us all that much about the prayer that the people had, except in that one chapter where they, what is it, chapter 9, where they go through that big, long prayer and they talk about finally at the end how they can only do it with God's help. Mm-hmm. But it also took their courageous persistence to keep it going. They had a lot of people who didn't want them to succeed. And we do today in our society. You know, more and more and more, true Christianity gets a bum rap, and it's there are people who are downright hostile,
right,
to what we're trying to do in people's lives, for not only for their benefit but for the glory of God. And if there's so many lessons to learn from Nehemiah, but one of the things I love about it is the fact that he didn't let all these distractions, even when they were attempts on his life to cause him to turn away from what his focus was. And I think that's real commitment. Real commitment is going to overcome distraction. And I don't know if I could be that focused when somebody's trying to lure me away to do me in, but Nehemiah was.
Well, staying on task is a big help to that. It's really easy not to get lured out into the plains of Ono when you have a job to do and you're determined to do it. Is there one particular verse that jumps out at you?
Well, let's see. How many verses are there in Nehemiah?
I don't know, 13 chapters, 20 or so.
There is one, and it's part of the verse. It's the very last sentence of the last verse. Uh-huh. Remember me, oh my God, for good. And, you know, when we talk about all this teamwork that was going on in Nehemiah, you know, back in chapter 3, he's got all kinds of people working together. Ultimately, what it is about what you do individually for the Lord. And Nehemiah's prayer reminds me of what the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews 6, where he says that God is not so unjust as to forget your work on behalf of the saints, on behalf of others. And this is what Nehemiah is praying for. Remember me for what I did. And the very idea of remembrance, you know, is not just, you know, bringing a memory to God as though he would forget, but that, you know, remembrance is about acting in behavior that's appropriate to the memory. And I think that's what Nehemiah is asking for. You know, remember me, you know, act towards me appropriate to what I've done for you. And of course, that's always the promise of God. You know, if it's a whole thing behind them following the law, if you obey me, then you'll live long in the land. If you don't, then I'm going to be faithful to the promises I made concerning the destruction that I promise I bring onto you. You know, it's the same way in the New Testament, under the New Covenant. God says that he will be faithful to us, and he is always faithful to his word. You know, that's what Paul says. That's what he wrote to Timothy. Even when we are faithless, he is faithful. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean that God is going to save us in our faithlessness, but it does mean that God is going to bring all of his promises to fruition, whatever they are. And if those promises concern condemnation because we've been knuckleheads, well, that's what God promised. But if we work for him, as we promised to do in our repentance and our baptism, then he's going to remember the good that we've done for him. You know, I love that. That's, it reminds me that prayer to God doesn't always have to be in this big, you know, flowery thee and thou language. Nehemiah just asks God not to forget him. Mm-hmm. And that's, for me, that's huge.
Well, when I wrote my workbook on Nehemiah, I called it Remember Me for Good. So I'm not going to argue with you on the significance of that. That's, and he says words to that effect, I think, three or four times in the in the text. When I saw an opportunity to do the wrong thing and I did the right thing, when there was an enemy trying to stop me, when there was opposition that seemed unreasonable, when people didn't seem to listen to me, you know, remember me for good. I did the right thing, or at least I tried to do the right thing. And, you know, the idea of trying, I have kind of come around on the idea of trying as in recent years. I used to think that try was the opposite of do. You know, it's an excuse basically for failure. And I have really changed on that. You know, God wants us to try. God is not as interested in our results as he is in our priorities, in our effort, our commitment. We go out there and we try. We do the best that we can in these situations. And sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes it does, like it did for Nehemiah.
What about the Yoda-ism? There is no try. There is only do.
There's only do. Well, I'm not sure that the spiritual parallels of the Jedi and New Testament Christianity line up as well as we might like to believe sometimes. But there is the requirement to put ourselves in position for God to judge us. And this is one of those subtle references to the afterlife, I think. Maybe not as clear-cut an example as you might find in other places, but there is the assumption that I'm going to be held accountable for the things that I'm doing. And I'm ready for that. I'm ready to stand before God and say, I did my best. I did what I had to do. And accountability, you know, going back to chapter 3, like you were talking about, this is the undercurrent through the entire book, really. This is people doing work and being held accountable for that work. If the wall crumbles in sector X, well, let's go back to Nehemiah's records. Who built it that? Oh, it's, you know, Bill built that. Well, that figures. Bill's kind of a knucklehead. It figures that he would fall down on the job. Everybody's name being attached, including the people who didn't go to the work occasionally.
Yeah,
it's important that we get credit for what we do. It's important that we get blamed for what we do wrong. And the idea of looking back at a life, or looking back at a project, looking back at your children and saying, this is generally what I did. There are good days and bad days, of course, but over a course of 20 years, over a course of 50 years, this is what I was trying to do. This is what I accomplished for the Lord. And I'm okay with that. I'll stand before God for that.
You know, sometimes when you go back and you reread through a passage, you kind of read it through the lens of whatever you're experiencing at the time. I don't know. I'm sure you've reread Nehemiah, you know, several times before this mm-hmm. podcast. What was the verse that you were thinking of when you reread it?
Well, the verse that you mentioned is central to the whole thing. The one that we oftentimes go to is chapter 4 and verse 6. I mentioned that a little bit before. The people had a mind to work. One of the verses that always jumps out at me, I forget which verse exactly it is, but you were mentioning prayer before. When Nehemiah is called on the carpet by the king, and you know, you don't usually come before me looking like this. There's something wrong. And he says, and I prayed to the Lord. And how long could that prayer possibly have lasted? You know, he knows this confrontation is coming. It looks like Nehemiah it maybe comes, right. It looks like it comes a little bit earlier than perhaps he was prepared for, but his heart is in the right place and he fully intends on doing the right thing. And all of a sudden, just boom, now you have the right opportunity to do the right thing. And before you engage in that, you take a second and a half or whatever and say, God be with me on this. You know, it doesn't have to be a long wordy prayer to connect with God. It's not about God, okay, I'm starting now. You need to start paying attention now. It's about me reminding myself, I'm about to go do God's work here and put myself in a God framework, put myself in the right kind of mental state, and then say what's in my heart, because I know that my heart is attuned to God's things. It'll turn out okay. God will help me with this.
you know, just the fact that it briefly mentions Nehemiah praying before he starts speaking to the king is just another one of those reminders that, hey, this was just part of Nehemiah's life. This is who he was. He was a constant prayer warrior, you know, and before this, before he presented his plan to the king, you get the idea that he had gone through all this stuff. He'd gone through the scenarios. He did his planning. He had his ducks in a row.
Right.
Sometimes I don't even know I'm supposed to have ducks. You know, he had his ducks in a row before he even started speaking to the king. And how did he do that? I mean, I'm sure he asked himself, like, well, is this really God's will that we rebuild the wall? You know, is it really God's will that we get together and start rebuilding Jerusalem? Well, of course it is. It was God's will that it's why he brought them out of Egypt.
Right.
You know, but I'm confident that Nehemiah didn't proceed in formulating these plans without asking himself, what would God do? What does God want?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was central to him. And I think that's, I don't know, even though these prayers that he gives, I wrote them all down. I reread them because they're so, not only so short, but they're so powerful. They're not always, pie in the sky. They're not pie in the sky prayers. And they're not just, man, I hope God does something about this. You see a hint of confidence in those prayers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. If you had to put one word on Nehemiah, what word would you choose?
It's that word we talked about before, the first word of Nehemiah's final prayer, remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've already talked about why. You know, remember is something that Nehemiah had asked God to do often. Remember, remember, remember. And it's not because, you know, things slip God's mind. I mean, who has a more perfect memory? But really, it was Nehemiah's way to deliver a plea to God that he would consider and act in a way that was appropriate to what Nehemiah was doing. And remember is what we need to do. We need to remember God. We need to remember one another. We need to remember our own duty. And Nehemiah never forgot that.
Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say, do you think that when we ask God to remember something from our life, we are naturally and pretty much unavoidably remembering ourselves, the things that we have done? We're reflecting on a lifetime. We're reflecting on a job or the growth of our children, whatever the issue happens to be there. If I'm wanting God to remember what I've done, in the process, I'm remembering. And not only am I remembering what I've done, I remember what my enemies have done, what my supporters have done, what those who have gone before me have went, and I took from their example, either positively or negatively took their example. The idea of using the past to form the future is one of the most pervasive themes in the Old Testament, I think. We're going to get into the Psalms before too long. So many of the Psalms look back at the flood. They look back at the life of David. They look back at creation itself. There is always a lesson to learn from what has gone before. And all of it should be drawing us closer to God.
Well, I was thinking about that when the people, they draw up this document. Of course, they already had one. It was called the covenant, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they draw up this document that says, hey, we're going to be committed and we're going to prove it because we're going to put our names down here, right? And then Nehemiah goes away and he comes back, what, 12 years later? And things are in a shambles again. You know, the temple's work is left undone. The people are violating the law by marrying foreign women and all this kind of stuff. And Nehemiah starts literally tearing into them. He's tearing their hair out and stuff. He's mm-hmm. he's after them. And, you know, there's so much probably that happened that's unrecorded. But I wonder how many times Nehemiah told them, remember what you promised. Remember what you said. Remember how you wrote down your name in a binding legal document to God and said, we're going to be faithful to you. You know, that's, you're right. I think, or, you know, remembering is not only asking God to think about us, it's about us thinking about ourselves.
And that idea of follow-up that you see in the last couple of chapters is so important. That's what what leaders do. Leaders pave the way. They check for progress. They turn people out on their own to work. And at some point, they're going to follow up. They're going to see how things are going. And although that wasn't part of Nehemiah's original mission back in chapter 2, that's I think it's implied. If I'm going to do this job, I'm going to find out whether it worked. And not just that he built the wall, that because the wall really, and I think the people intuitively knew this, it's not just about building up a wall around a city. It's building a wall around our national character, around our national identity, who we are as a nation, and identifying ourselves there. And, you know, this is a political football. It has been for the last however many years. You know, why do we build walls? Because there are people who belong on the inside, and there are people who belong on the outside. And we know that intuitively. And one way or the other, whatever form that wall may take, whether it's a legal wall or a physical wall or whatever, there needs to be a distinction made. And when Nehemiah comes along and realizes a wall is not going to fix the Tobiah problem. Tobiah walks right in through the gate. Tobiah's on the inside already. A wall, a physical wall, isn't keeping him out. There is a moral wall. There is a spiritual wall that has to be built and maintained so that people will appreciate the difference between us and them, which may seem, you know, arrogant. It may seem racist. It may seem whatever. But there is a difference. There's always been a difference between Jacob and Esau. There's always been a difference between Jews and Gentiles. There's always, in God's mind, a separation and a wall in between. And pretending like there isn't a wall is not doing anybody any favors. We have to and we build the wall where God tells us to put the wall, obviously. We build God's wall. We define things properly and allow him to keep us separated. And respect the boundaries that he's put out for us.
One of the problems that the church has had historically is drawing these ever narrowing circles mm-hmm. about who's in my circle and who's not. And sometimes there are good reasons for doing that. But in Nehemiah, when Nehemiah confronts the guys who are charging this exorbitant usury against their countrymen, he reminds them that they're God's people, that right. they have, you know, that the circle includes them, that wall you're talking about is in a lot of ways, it's exclusive, but it's also inclusive. And those who belong on the inside need to be reminded that there are others who belong on the inside. Nehemiah does a good job at that. We need more leaders like Nehemiah. We need more elders like Nehemiah. We need more preachers like Nehemiah. We need more folks in the pew like Nehemiah.
Oh, absolutely. Parents, left out parents. Don't do that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great discussion. Thank you so much, Zeke, for pitching in. Appreciate you being here very much.
Already?
Looks like our time's about out. We'll cut you loose here. But thank you for joining in. We have Esther next week, so be reading over that if you're following along with the 20 Pages a Week program. And get set up for Job and Psalms and such coming up after that. Thanks again to Jerry Tesh and Narrow Way for their good work. www.narrowway.com.